Why is the shopping cart always in the top right of the screen?
How do companies predict my purchases?
Why do prices end in 9?
Why do fast food companies use red and yellow in their logos?
Why do restaurants always have one expensive menu item?
Researchers, marketers, and very curious people seek the answers for how we make decisions and how we choose products. ClickSuasion finds the secrets that companies use and shares them with you.
Why do I feel better when I bought the last remaining airline ticket?
How do I make choices based on colors and fonts?
Welcome back to ClickSuasion. This is Michael Barbera. We've brought back Caroline Glacken to the show. This is her second time on ClickSuasion. Back again to talk to us about a popular topic about finance and where can we get it from. So really, we're going to talk about microfinance, behavioral economics, and how entrepreneurs can benefit from it. So a little bit about Caroline Glacken. We know that she is faculty at Fayetteville State University. We know that she attended or graduated with an MBA at the Wharton School, and we know that you can find her publications in some textbooks. Caroline, what don't we know about you?
Well, I like social dance, and I'm a trivia nut. So they're pretty not usually on the resume.
What is social dance?
Social dance is ballroom dance taken down from the competitive level to the normal human being level.
So you like to compete on trivia, but not to compete on the dance floor.
I'm not that good.
Can we throw out some random trivia for you?
Oh, please don't.
Will you be the next
Ken Jennings on Jeopardy? That's a team sport, my dear.
Hey, Jeopardy's not a team sport.
No, it isn't.
When should we expect you to be on Jeopardy?
Probably never.
Never. That's a bad word to use.
I know. Well, let's put it this way. I'm not that good yet.
Okay. All right. Small wins.
Been working on getting people to say, I can't do it yet.
I will accept that. So microfinance, I'm going to be the adversary. I like macrofinance. I like a lot of money. So what is microfinance and why would I want it?
Microfinance in the U.S. context is actually defined as a number of components. Most people think of micro loans, which are typically defined as loans of under $50,000 to companies with 5 or fewer employees, including the owner. But microfinance now includes some insurance products. It also includes micro equity, which are small infusions of equity. And it really doesn't include the crowdfunding equity, but it could if you really wanted to stretch it.
Okay, so we've got 5 or fewer employees. That includes the owner or the proprietor of the business, and then $50,000 or less. Is that right for the loans?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that number has grown over the last 15 years or so from 15,000 up to 50 now.
What kind of institutions would be willing to give out a microloan, since obviously institutions make money on the loans on the interest?
Right. Well, microloans, in essence, one of the reasons they were created is because of a gap in the market that commercial lending really doesn't want to deal with loans that small, because it takes them as long to process one as it does for a much bigger loan. So typically you will have community partners. The SBA program, which is the largest single program, I'd say, works with not-for-profit, typically certified community development financial institutions that specialize in working with the small and emerging businesses. Other organizations have been traditional women's organizations, women's support organizations, economic development organizations, and also refugee resettlement organizations.
So for $50,000 being usually the cap for the top end, is there a minimum that lenders want to see or request for?
Depends on the program. Programs are as varied as the organizations running them. So say there are 600 organizations these days running microloan programs, you probably find about 580 variations. But some of the smaller organizations, the peer-to-peer ones, were starting at $500, and I think they're now going up. That's $100, not $500,000, obviously, and going up to a few thousand. Now, I believe that most of them start at a minimum of $1,500. A lot of programs still cap at $15,000. Typically, though, an average microloan in a program today is more in the $15,000. They don't all cap out, as one might think.
So
they
when it comes to the lower amounts, $1,500, $2,000, maybe even $5,000, to some people, that's a lot of money. And to some other people, it's not much money at all. At what point would or how would the decision-making process go for an entrepreneur to say, I need to borrow or go through the lending process for $1,500 opposed to, say, charging their credit card or asking their friends, family, and associates?
Well, friends, family, and founders are really I was going to say fools, but I was behaving myself today. Friends, families, and founders are the primary source. But, for example, when I ran a loan fund, those many years ago, a lot of people had burned a number of their bridges with those folks, or think about a person who is living in poverty or near the poverty line. They typically don't have a lot of friends and family with money to lend either. So that's not really an option for them. And the credit card is also not an option. Perhaps they've had a severe medical situation that has put them in poor financial straits. They may have quite literally no credit history, not a bad credit history even, but no credit history. Or they may have made some mistakes and gotten not good credit. And for them, $1,500 is a huge amount. And to other people, yeah, you put it on your credit card and move on. But that's really not who the smaller end programs are designed for. They tend to be poverty alleviation and
so this is
programs.
Kind of a double-edged sword, I guess, because you have the entrepreneur who obviously needs the capital and hopefully would put it to good use. And then you have the organization, the lender, who is willing to give the capital to the entrepreneur, but also has to protect themselves. So they have a social mission, but they also have to manage and operate a business. What kind of protections would the microloan lender have to protect their entity or their assets more so, or with entrepreneur with a lower credit score or a higher risk, as opposed to, say, a traditional commercial lender that would go after someone with a higher dollar amount, higher or better credit?
That was actually the nexus of my research, because I was trying to understand what do we do that's necessary and what do we not. There are underwriting criteria. You have to understand that typically these lenders are relending money that they've borrowed from other people. So, I had pension fund money from nuns in my fund. I certainly did not want to not be able to repay the nuns their pension money. So we had to figure out how to kind of balance things out. And some things that organizations do is they require training or technical assistance, which is one-on-one counseling. They may require, frankly, some form of experience. Some of the more established programs actually require 6 months of documented business experience. Other organizations, and we did a lot of work on this some years ago, were looking at, well, how can you do credit scoring for somebody who doesn't meet traditional credit criteria? And what is equivalent? Is regular savings an equivalent thing? Is paying their rent and their utilities on time a possible equivalent? Trying to be more creative about the ways that you look at what is parallel to the 5 C's of credit that are used by traditional lenders. Right. Lenders usually have what they call the 5 C's of credit, and different lenders call them slightly differently, but typically they include collateral or property or assets that can be pledged, character, which is actually not what one would think, but it's your credit history. Capacity is the ability to pay back the money, because ultimately what the lender want is their money, their interest, and any fees, right? Capital is how much have you put in. What they want to know is that you've got some, as they say, skin in the game. They want you to know that you've got an investment in the business. And then the more general conditions is a look at what's the industry doing and what's the economic climate. So what we try to do, and microlenders, as I'm not one anymore, is to try to balance out those things that are a little more difficult for people who might be at the bottom of the pyramid, to say the least.
So the next time that I have to go get debt lending from or debt financing from somewhere, I'm going to use your phrase. I'm going to say, I don't meet traditional guidelines for, how did you say it? Traditional guidelines for funding or for credit history?
Yeah, for creditworthiness.
I'm going to see how that works out for my family.
Try that. See how that works out for you. I'm guessing that it won't work real well.
Probably not.
No. But, these programs are designed for people who don't meet the traditional criteria, but they can't give away money. They don't give loans. They issue loans, and they need to have repayment. It just takes a lot more patience, right? Sometimes you really have to work with people and give them a lot more attention. But there are a lot of things that sort of frighten people away, even with that flexibility. So,
what would be some typical collateral for a microloan?
If you're looking at the higher end of that, sometimes people do have homes. And sometimes at the small end, you can end up with something like a diamond engagement ring, which to somebody who has, that's their most valuable asset that they own, is a really big psychological factor, right? They don't want to lose that ring. So it's really dependent on the size of the loan, what's available. Some of them are not collateralized, frankly. It just depends on the size of the loan and the lender and the parameters.
So on the lending side, on the entrepreneur side, the endowment effect comes into play, where you don't want to give up something of value of yourself or something that you value in your family as collateral. How would the lender use behavioral economics or behavioral finance in the process?
Well, they're trying to help, first of all, build trust. And, that is clearly a big factor in behavioral economics.
I'd say it's a big factor in finance, too. I wouldn't let you borrow money from me if I didn't trust you.
Right, if you didn't trust. So they're really trying to get a sense of trust. They also are trying to help frame the borrowing in the larger context. When we think about loss aversion and overweighting sense of present and future, one of the things happens is that people will not take a loan because they're too afraid of that loss happening, rather than looking at what they're getting as an opportunity. And so lenders need to focus on working with the borrower, not to convince them of something that's not right, but to help make that waiting more long range. They also have to address the mental accounting issues. People think of things in different value terms, and they're not thinking about the process overall. They also, look at sunk costs. A lot of times the customers and a lot of the work that I was doing looked at what kind of cash costs are the borrowers putting in? How much time are they investing? What's it take to go through this process? And for a lender, it has to be sufficiently rigorous that they've reached a comfort zone that they're going to get repaid, but not so rigorous that they're going to scare away 90.99% of all potential borrowers. And that's that fine edge that seems to be a challenge. So behavioral economics takes a lot in there, and from the borrower perspective, even more so.
Yeah, it could take a lot for a person to admit that they don't have money, or they need money, or that mm-hmm. they are of a lower socioeconomic status. It could take a lot for a person to come out and admit that, and a person to say that to a lender. There might be a segment of the population, and you can maybe correct me on this, that may avoid seeking a microloan or any loan because they're too afraid to admit that they don't have sufficient capital. Is that a thing?
It's more than a thing.
Okay, tell me more.
There are a couple of things. One is when you think about the availability heuristic, people are going to think that something's more likely to happen because an example comes to mind. And over the years, the image of the banker hasn't exactly been very favorable. And in minority communities in particular, this has been studied pretty heavily. And people don't apply for loans because they expect to be turned down. They don't even bother to make that call to even have to reveal their situation. And they have confirmation biases. They're looking for confirmation of that. You know, my buddy went and, you know, he went in and he didn't get what he wanted, so I'm not likely to get it either. And they look at sort of their similarity to other people and see that. And then that's really kind of disconcerting in a lot of ways. And the other thing is that if you're overweighting the loss potential to the gain potential, you're going to be averse to doing that. And honestly, as we went and called on people and went and met with community groups, in some of the neighborhoods, people were honestly more comfortable talking to the neighborhood loan shark than they were to the folks from that organized loan fund place, which is very disturbing, but true.
What are some ways that we could, say, reframe the perception of the traditional lender or that banker down the street that it gives a more positive perception of their role in the community?
Well, the broader solution in some ways is there's some policy-based things that go with that, but there's also, I hate to jump to liberalism, paternalism, but presenting opportunities and requirements in a way that it makes it easier to make the best choice for the individual, rather than making a ton of hoops and hurdles and barriers and constraints, to really think through how do we change the paradigm on this. And even the best intended not-for-profits, organizations that are pretty grassroots, have a really hard time building that trust factor. And I think lifting up successes and being present and meeting people where they are is probably the first most important piece.
So the trust kind of goes two ways. So the entrepreneur needs to trust the lender, and of course the lender needs to trust the entrepreneur that they'll get their loan back and they'll get repaid.
Right.
What are some things, so we talked about what the lenders can do, possibly. What could the recipients of the loan do to potentially increase their trust with the lender?
The borrower needs to make clear up front what their expectations are in working with the loan fund or the lender. And the lender needs to be more clear and transparent about the requirements. I think a lot of the issues that have arisen that I interviewed people about during my research and other things were due to things feeling like they were opaque, or that decisions were having to be made sequentially rather than with a full understanding of what was involved. And that's problematic from both sides. If you came to me and you said, I really want to start this laundry service in this community where almost everyone's a renter and, you know, it's really a challenge and I really want to do this. And we say, okay, how much money do you think you need? And we get settled on that. And you don't tell me, for example, that you had savings, but you've used them all and you've already got a lease on a building and you're going to run out of money in 2 weeks. That's not helpful, right?
Of course not. But right. It happens.
It happens all the time. Or, you know, we're going to pull a credit report. Most places would pull a credit report and ask for a credit explanation letter. Better to make an honest assessment of what happened, because a lender oftentimes would, at least in my mind and with the people I've worked with, they'd rather lend to somebody who's been through adversity and they can see what they did in that adversity. In an odd way, it kind of shows that character piece. And so, you know, did you enter into agreements to repay? Were you able to repay? You know, what did you do to get where you are? Better to understand that. And even if it's, I did this really silly thing, but I figured it out and I got this now, I'm just not bankable by traditional terms. Clearly, I mean, we had people who had four identities. That isn't helpful, but that would be true in any lending situation, I would assume.
Well, what if you wanted four loans?
Yeah, no, four separate social security. No, four separate driver's license numbers. Yeah, nifty. And they put two or three of them on their application.
I'll try that. I'm going to try both of those things next time I need to get a loan. Is four driver's licenses, four loans, and I don't really meet traditional lending standards.
Yeah, you try that. See where it gets you.
Thanks for listening to ClickSuasion. Subscribe to the podcast, read our research, and get in touch with us at ClickSuasion.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @ClickSuasion.